At high levels of inequality and or low levels of social capital in a country predict high rates of bullying and of antisocial punishment. Chapter 11 examines the psychology with which we think about people of different socioeconomic status. No surprise, in unequal societies, people on top generate justifications for their status. And the more inequality, the more the powerful adhere to myths about the hidden blessings of subordination. They may be poor, but at least they're happy, slash, honest, slash, loved. In the words of the authors of one paper, unequal societies may need ambivalence for system stability. Income inequality compensates groups with partially positive social images. Thus, unequal cultures make people less kind. Inequality also makes people less healthy. This helps explain a hugely important phenomenon in public health, namely the socioeconomic status, SES, slash health gradient. As noted, in culture after culture, the poorer you are, the worse your health, the higher the incidence and impact of numerous diseases, and the shorter your life expectancy. Extensive research has examined the SES slash health gradient. Four quick rule-outs. A. The gradient isn't due to poor health driving down people's SES. Instead, low SES, beginning in childhood, predicts subsequent poor health in adulthood. B. It's not that the poor have lousy health and everyone else is equally healthy. Instead, for every step down the SES ladder, starting from the top, average health worsens. C. The gradient isn't due to less healthcare access for the poor. It occurs in countries with universal healthcare, is unrelated to utilization of healthcare systems, and occurs for diseases unrelated to healthcare access, e.g. juvenile diabetes, where having 5 checkups a day wouldn't change its incidence. D. Only about a third of the gradient is explained by lower SES equaling more health risk factors, e.g. lead in your water, nearby toxic waste dump, more smoking and drinking, and fewer protective factors, e.g. everything from better mattresses for overworked backs to health club memberships. What then is the principal cause of the gradient? Key work by Nancy Adler at UCSF showed that it's not so much being poor that predicts poor health. It's feeling poor. Someone's subjective SES, e.g. the answer to, how do you feel you're doing financially when you compare yourself with other people, is at least as good a predictor of health as is objective SES. Crucial work by the social epidemiologist Richard Wilkinson of the University of Nottingham added to this picture, it's not so much that poverty predicts poor health, it's poverty amid plenty, income inequality. The surest way to make someone feel poor is to rub their nose in what they don't have. Why should high degrees of income inequality, independent of absolute levels of poverty, make the poor unhealthy? Two overlapping pathways. A psychosocial explanation has been championed by Ichiro Kawachi of Harvard. When social capital decreases, thanks to inequality, up goes psychological stress. A mammoth amount of literature explores how such stress, lack of control, predictability, outlets for frustration, and social support chronically activates the stress response, which, as we saw in Chapter 4, corrodes health in numerous ways. A neo-materialist explanation has been offered by Robert Evans of the University of British Columbia and George Kaplan of the University of Michigan. If you want to improve health and quality of life for the average person in a society, you spend money on public goods, better public transit, safer streets, cleaner water, better public schools, universal health care. But the more income inequality, the greater the financial distance between the wealthy and the average, and thus the less direct benefit the wealthy feel from improving public goods. Instead, they benefit more from dodging taxes and spending on their private good, a chauffeur, a gated community, bottled water, private schools, private health insurance. As Evans writes, the more unequal our incomes in a society, the more pronounced will be the disadvantages to its better-off members from public expenditure, and the more resources will those members have available to them to mount effective political opposition, e.g. lobbying. Evans notes how this secession of the wealthy promotes private affluence and public squalor, meaning worse health for the have-nots. The inequality health link paves the way for understanding how inequality also makes for more crime and violence. I could copy and paste the previous stretch of writing, replacing poor health with high crime, and I'd be set. Poverty is not a predictor of crime as much as poverty amid plenty is. For example, extent of income inequality is a major predictor of rates of violent crime across American states and across industrialized nations. Why does income inequality lead to more crime? Again, there's the psychosocial angle. Inequality means less social capital, less trust, cooperation, and people watching out for one another. And there's the neo-materialist angle. Inequality means more secession of the wealthy from contributing to the public good. Kaplan has shown, for example, that states with more income inequality spend proportionately less money on that key crime-fighting tool, education. As with inequality and health, the psychosocial and neo-material roots synergize. A final depressing point about inequality and violence. As we've seen, a rat being shocked activates a stress response. But a rat being shocked, who can then bite the hell out of another rat, has less of a stress response. Likewise with baboons. If you are low-ranking, a reliable way to reduce glucocorticoid secretion is to displace aggression onto those even lower in the pecking order. It's something similar here. Despite the conservative nightmare of class warfare, of the poor rising up to slaughter the wealthy, when inequality fuels violence, it is mostly the poor preying on the poor. This point is made with a great metaphor for the consequences of societal inequality. The frequency of air rage, a passenger majorly, disruptively, dangerously losing it over something on a flight, has been increasing. Turns out there's a substantial predictor of it. If the plane has a first-class section, there's almost a fourfold increase in the odds of a coach passenger having air rage. Force coach passengers to walk through first class when boarding, and you more than double the chances further. Nothing like starting a flight by being reminded of where you fit into the class hierarchy. And completing the parallel with violent crime, when air rage is boosted in coach by reminders of inequality, the result is not a crazed coach passenger sprinting into first class to shout Marxist slogans. It's the guy being awful to the old woman sitting next to him, or to the flight attendant. Ironic footnote, when coach passengers board through first class, the rate of air rage related to a sense of entitlement increases even more among the first class passengers. Population size, population density, population heterogeneity. The year 2008 marked a human milestone, a transition point 9,000 years in the making. For the first time, the majority of humans lived in cities. The human trajectory from semi-permanent settlements to the megalopolis has been beneficial. In the developed world, when compared with rural populations, city dwellers are typically healthier and wealthier. Larger social networks facilitate innovation. Because of economies of scale, cities leave a smaller per capita ecological footprint. Urban living makes for a different sort of brain. This was shown in a 2011 study of subjects from a range of cities, towns, and rural settings who underwent an experimental social stressor while being brain scanned. The key finding was that the larger the population where someone lived, the more reactive their amygdala was during that stressor. Most important for our purposes, urbanized humans do something completely unprecedented among primates, regularly encountering strangers who are never seen again, fostering the invention of the anonymous act. After all, it wasn't until 19th century urbanization that crime fiction was invented, typically set in cities. In traditional settings, there's no whodunit, since everyone knows what everyone done. Growing cultures had to invent mechanisms for norm enforcement among strangers. For example, across numerous traditional cultures, the larger the group, the greater the punishment for norm violations, and the more cultural emphasis on equitable treatment of strangers. Moreover, larger groups evolved third-party punishment. Stay tuned for more in the next chapter. Rather than victims punishing norm violators, punishment is meted out by objective third parties, such as police and courts. At an extreme, a crime not only victimizes its victim, but also is an affront to the collective population, hence the people versus Joe Blow. Footnote. The online world is now undergoing cultural evolution, wrestling with how to deal with the toxic behavior of some people online when they are shielded behind anonymity. Psychologists are even doing experiments, gifted with mammoth databases, to see how best to curb such behavior with top-down approaches, e.g., being banned by authorities, and interventions driven by peers, i.e., other players. Finally, life in larger populations fosters the ultimate third-party punisher. As documented by Aranor and Zion of the University of British Columbia, it is only when societies grow large enough that people regularly encounter strangers that big gods emerge, deities who are concerned with human morality and punish our transgressions. Societies with frequent anonymous interactions tend to outsource punishment to gods. In contrast, hunter-gatherers' gods are less likely than chance to care whether we've been naughty or nice. Moreover, in further work across a range of traditional cultures, Noren Zion has shown that the more informed and punitive people consider their moralistic gods to be, the more generous they are to co-religionist strangers in a financial allocation game. Separate from the size of a population, how about its density? One study surveying 33 developed countries characterized each nation's tightness, the extent to which the government is autocratic, dissent suppressed, behavior monitored, transgressions punished, life regulated by religious orthodoxy, citizens viewing various behaviors as inappropriate, e.g. singing in an elevator, cursing at a job interview. Higher population density predicted tighter cultures, both high density in the present and, remarkably, historically, in the year 1500. The issue of population density's effects on behavior gave rise to a well-known phenomenon, mostly well-known incorrectly. In the 1950s, John Calhoun at the National Institute of Mental Health asked what happens to rat behavior at higher population densities, research prompted by America's ever-growing cities. And in papers for both scientists and the lay public, Calhoun gave a clear answer. High-density living produced deviant behavior and social pathology. Rats became violent. Adults killed and cannibalized one another. Females were aggressive to their infants. There was indiscriminate hypersexuality among males, e.g. trying to mate with females who weren't an estrus. The writing about the subject, starting with Calhoun, was colorful. The bloodless description of high-density living was replaced with crowding. Aggressive males were described as going berserk, aggressive females as Amazons. Rats living in these rat slums became social dropouts, autistic or juvenile delinquents. One expert on rat behavior, A.S. Parks, described Calhoun's rats as unmaternal mothers, homosexuals, and zombies. Quite the trio you'd invite to dinner in the 1950s. The work was hugely influential, taught to psychologists, architects, and urban planners. More than 1 million reprints were requested of Calhoun's original Scientific American report. Sociologists, journalists, and politicians explicitly compared residents of particular housing projects and Calhoun's rats. The take-home message sent ripples through the American heartland destined for the chaotic 60s. Inner cities breed violence, pathology, and social deviance. Calhoun's rats were more complicated than this, something underemphasized in his lay writing. High-density living doesn't make rats more aggressive. Instead, it makes aggressive rats more aggressive. This echoes the findings that neither testosterone, nor alcohol, nor media violence uniformly increases violence. Instead, they make violent individuals more sensitive to violence-evoking social cues. In contrast, crowding makes unaggressive individuals more timid. In other words, it exaggerates pre-existing social tendencies. Calhoun's erroneous conclusions about rats don't even hold for humans. In some cities, Chicago, for example, circa 1970, Higher population density in neighborhoods does indeed predict more violence. Nevertheless, some of the highest density places on Earth, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Tokyo, have minuscule rates of violence. High density living is not synonymous with aggression in rats or humans. The preceding sections examined the effects of living with lots of people and in close quarters. How about the effects of living with different kinds of people? Diversity, heterogeneity, admixture, mosaicism. Two opposite narratives come to mind. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. When people of differing ethnicities, races, or religions live together, they experience the similarities rather than the differences and view one another as individuals, transcending stereotypes. Trade flows, fostering fairness and mutuality. Inevitably, dichotomies dissolve with intermarriage, and soon you're happily watching your grandkid in the school play on their side of town. Just visualize world peace. Sharks versus the Jets. Differing sorts of people living in close proximity rub and thus abrade elbows regularly. One side's act of proud cultural identification feels like a hostile dig to the other side. Public spaces become proving grounds for turf battles. Commons become tragedies. Surprise, both outcomes occur. The final chapter explores circumstances where intergroup contact leads to one rather than the other. Most interesting at this juncture is the importance of the spatial qualities of the heterogeneity. Consider a region filled with people from Elbonia and Kerplakistan, two hostile groups, each providing half the population. At one extreme, the land is split down the middle, each group occupying one side, producing a single boundary between the two. At the other extreme is a micro checkerboard of alternating ethnicities, where each square on the grid is one person large, producing a vast quantity of boundaries between Elbonians and Kerplakis. Intuitively, both scenarios should bias against conflict. In the condition of maximal separation, each group has a critical mass to be locally sovereign, and the total length of border and thus of the amount of intergroup elbow rubbing is minimized. In the scenario of maximal mixing, no patch of ethnic homogeneity is big enough to foster a self-identity that can dominate a public space. Big deal if someone raises a flag between their feet and declares their square meter to be the Elbonian Empire or a Kerplakistani Republic. But in the real world, things are always in between the two extremes and with variation in the average size of each ethnic patch. Does patch size, and thus amount of border, influence relations? This was explored in a fascinating paper from the aptly named New England Complex Systems Institute, down the block from MIT. The authors first constructed an Elbonian-slash-Kerplaki mixture, with individuals randomly distributed as pixels on a grid. Pixels were given a certain degree of mobility, plus a tendency to assort with other pixels of the same type. As self-assortment progresses, something emerges. Islands and peninsulas of Elbonians amid a sea of Kerplakis, or the reverse, a condition that intuitively seems rife with potential intergroup violence. As self-assortment continues, the number of such isolated islands and peninsulas declines. The intermediate stage that maximizes the number of islands and peninsulas maximizes the number of people living within a surrounded enclave. The authors then considered a Balkanized region, namely the Balkans, ex-Yugoslavia in 1990. This was just before Serbians, Bosnians, Croatians, and Albanians commenced Europe's worst war since World War II. The war that taught us the names of places like Srebrenica and people like Slobodan Milosevic. Using a similar analysis, with ethnic island size varying from roughly 20 to 60 kilometers in diameter, they identified the spots theoretically most rife for violence. Remarkably, this predicted the sites of major fighting and massacres in the war. In the words of the authors, violence can arise due to the structure of boundaries between groups rather than as a result of inherent conflicts between the groups themselves. They then showed that the clarity of borders matters as well. good, clear-cut fences, e.g. mountain ranges or rivers between groups, make for good neighbors. Peace does not depend on integrated coexistence, but rather on well-defined topographical and political boundaries separating groups, allowing for partial autonomy within a single country, the authors concluded. Thus, not only do size, density, and heterogeneity of populations help explain intergroup violence, but patterns and clarity of fragmentation do as well. These issues will be revisited in the final chapter. The residues of cultural crises. In times of crisis, the London Blitz, New York after 9/11, San Francisco after the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, people pull together. That's cool. But in contrast, chronic, pervasive, corrosive menace doesn't necessarily do the same to people or cultures. The primal menace of hunger has left historical marks. Back to that study of differences between countries' tightness, where tight countries were characterized by autocracy, suppression of dissent, and omnipresence and enforcement of behavior norms. What sorts of countries are tighter? In addition to the high population density correlates mentioned earlier, there are also more historical food shortages, lower food intake, and lower levels of protein and fat in the diet. In other words, these are cultures chronically menaced by empty stomachs. Cultural tightness was also predicted by environmental degradation, less available farmland or clean water, more pollution. Similarly, habitat degradation and depletion of animal populations worsens conflict in cultures dependent on bushmeat, and a major theme of Jared Diamond's magisterial Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, is how environmental degradation explains the violent collapse of many civilizations. Then there's disease. In Chapter 15, we'll touch on behavioral immunity, the ability of numerous species to detect cues of illness in other individuals. As we'll see, implicit cues about infectious disease make people more xenophobic. Similarly, historical prevalence of infectious disease predicts a culture's openness to outsiders. Moreover, other predictors of cultural tightness include having high historical incidence of pandemics, of high infant and child mortality rates, and of higher cumulative average number of years lost to communicable disease. Obviously, weather influences the incidence of organized violence. Consider the centuries of European wars taking a hiatus during the worst of winter and the growing season. Even broader is the capacity of weather and climate to shape culture. The Kenyan historian Ali Mazrui has suggested that one reason for Europe's historical success relative to Africa has been the weather. Western-style planning ahead arose from the annual reality of winter coming. Larger-scale changes in weather are known to be consequential. In the tightness study, cultural tightness was also predicted by a history of floods, droughts, and cyclones. Another pertinent aspect of weather concerns the Southern Oscillation, known as El Niño, the multi-year fluctuation of average water temperatures in the equatorial Pacific Ocean. El Niños, occurring about every dozen years, involve warmer, drier weather, with the opposite during La Niña years, and are associated in many developing countries with droughts and food shortages. Over the last 50 years, El Niños have roughly doubled the likelihood of civil conflict, mostly by stoking the fires of pre-existing conflicts. The relationship between drought and violence is tricky. The civil conflict referred to in the previous paragraph concerned deaths caused by battle between governmental and non-governmental forces, i.e., civil wars or insurgencies. Thus, rather than fighting over a watering hole or a field for grazing, this was fighting for modern perks of power. But in traditional settings, drought may mean spending more time foraging or hauling water for your crops. Raiding to steal the other group's women isn't a high priority. And why rustle someone else's cows when you can't even feed your own? Conflict declines. Interestingly, something similar occurs in baboons. Normally, baboons in rich ecosystems like the Serengeti need forage only a few hours a day. Part of what endears baboons to primatologists is that this leaves them about 9 hours daily to devote to social machinations, trysting and jousting and backbiting. In 1984, there was a devastating drought in East Africa. Among baboons, while there was still sufficient food, it took every waking moment to get enough calories. Aggression decreased. So ecological duress can increase or decrease aggression. This raises the key issue of what global warming will do to our best and worst behaviors. There will definitely be some upsides. Some regions will have longer growing seasons, increasing the food supply and reducing tensions. Some people will eschew conflict, being preoccupied with saving their homes from the encroaching ocean or growing pineapples in the Arctic. But amid squabbling about the details and predictive models, the consensus is that global warming won't do good things to global conflict. For starters, warmer temperatures rile people up. In cities during the summers, for every 3-degree increase in temperature, there was a 4% increase in interpersonal violence and 14% in group violence. But global warming's bad news is more global. Desertification, loss of arable land due to rising seas, more droughts. One influential meta-analysis projected 16% and 50% increases in interpersonal and group violence, respectively, in some regions by 2050. Oh, why not? Religion. Time for a quick hit and run about religion before considering it in the final chapter. Theories abound as to why humans keep inventing religions. It's more than a human pull toward the supernatural. As stated in one review, Mickey Mouse has supernatural powers, but no one worships or would fight or kill for him. Our social brains may help explain why children the world over are attracted to talking teacups, but religion is much more than that. Why does religion arise? Because it makes in-groups more cooperative and viable. Stay tuned for more in the next chapter. Because humans need personification and to see agency and causality when facing the unknown. Or maybe inventing deities is an emergent byproduct of the architecture of our social brains. Amid these speculations, far more boggling is the variety of the thousands of religions we've invented. They vary as to number and gender of deities, whether there's an afterlife, what it's like, and what it takes to enter, whether deities judge or interfere with humans, whether we are born sinful or pure, and whether sexuality changes those states, whether the myth of a religion's founder is of sacredness from the start, so much so that, say, wise men visit the infant founder, or of a sybarite who reforms, e.g. Siddhartha's transition from palace life to being the Buddha, whether the religion's goal is attracting new followers, say, with exciting news, e.g. an angel visited me in Manchester, New York and gave me golden plates, or retaining members. We've got a covenant with God, so stick with us. On and on. There are some pertinent patterns amid this variation. As noted, desert cultures are prone toward monotheistic religions, rainforest dwellers, polytheistic ones. Nomadic pastoralists, deities, tend to value war and valor in battle as an entree to a good afterlife. Agriculturalists invent gods who alter the weather. As noted, once cultures get large enough that anonymous acts are possible, they start inventing moralizing gods. Gods and religious orthodoxy dominate more in cultures with frequent threats, war, natural disasters, inequality, and high infant mortality rates. Before turfing this subject to the final chapter, three obvious points. A religion reflects the values of the culture that invented or adopted it, and very effectively transmits those values. B. Religion fosters the best and worst of our behaviors. C. It's complicated. We've now looked at various cultural factors. Collectivism versus individualism, egalitarian versus hierarchical distribution of resources, and so on. While there are others to consider, it's time to shift to the chapter's final topic. This is one that has generated shitstorms of debate as old as the weathered layers of Olduvai Gorge and as fresh as a newborn baby's tush, a topic that has scientists who study peace at one another's throats. Hobbes or Rousseau? Yes, those guys. To invoke some estimates, Anatomically modern humans emerged about 200,000 years ago, and behaviorally modern ones about 40,000 to 50,000 years ago. Animal domestication is 10,000 to 20,000 years old, agriculture around 12,000. After plant domestication, it was roughly 5,000 more years until history began with civilizations in Egypt, the Mideast, China, and the New World. When in this arc of history was war invented? Does material culture lessen or worsen tendencies toward war? Do successful warriors leave more copies of their genes? Has the centralization of authority by civilization actually civilized us, providing a veneer of socially contractual restraint? Have humans become more or less decent to one another over the course of history? Yes, it's short, nasty, brutish versus noble savage. In contrast to the centuries of food fights among philosophers, contemporary Hobbes versus Rousseau is about actual data. Some of it is archaeological, where researchers have sought to determine the prevalence and antiquity of warfare from the archaeological record. Predictably, half of each conference on the subject consists of definitional squabbles. Is war solely organized and sustained violence between groups? Does it require weapons? A standing army, even if only seasonally. An army with hierarchy and chain of command. If fighting is mostly along lines of relatedness, is it a vendetta or clan feud instead of a war? Fractured bones. For most archaeologists, the operational definition has been streamlined to numerous people simultaneously meeting violent deaths. In 1996, the archaeologist Lawrence Keeley of the University of Illinois synthesized the existing literature in his highly influential War Before Civilization, The Myth of the Peaceful Savage, ostensibly showing that the archaeological evidence for war is broad and ancient. A similar conclusion comes in the 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, by Harvard's Steven Pinker. Cliché police be damned, you can't mention this book without calling it monumental. In this monumental work, Pinker argued that A. violence and the worst horrors of inhumanity have been declining for the last half millennium, thanks to the constraining forces of civilization, and B. the warfare and barbarity preceding that transition are as old as the human species. Keeley and Pinker document savagery galore in prehistoric tribal societies, mass graves filled with skeletons bearing multiple fractures, caved-in skulls, parrying fractures, which arise from raising your arm to fend off a blow, stone projectiles embedded in bone. Some sites suggest the outcome of battle, a preponderance of young adult male skeletons. Others suggest indiscriminate massacre, butchered skeletons of both sexes and all ages. Other sites suggest cannibalism of the vanquished. In their separate surveys of the literature, Keeley and Pinker present evidence of pre-state tribal violence coming from sites in Ukraine, France, Sweden, Niger, India, and numerous pre-contact American locations. This collection of sites includes the oldest such massacre, the 12,000 to 14,000-year-old Jebel Sahaba site along the Nile in northern Sudan, a cemetery of 59 men, women, and children, nearly half of whom have stone projectiles embedded in their bones. And it includes the largest massacre site, the 700-year-old Crow Creek in South Dakota, a mass grave of more than 400 skeletons, with 60% showing evidence of violent deaths. Across the 21 sites surveyed, about 15% of skeletons showed evidence of death in warfare. One can, of course, be killed in war in a way that doesn't leave fractures or projectiles embedded in bone, suggesting that the percentage of deaths due to warfare was higher. Keeley and Pinker also document how prehistoric settlements frequently protected themselves with defensive palisades and fortifications. And, of course, as the poster child for prehistoric violence, there is Ötzi, the 5,300-year-old Tyrolean Iceman, found in a melting glacier in 1991 on the Italian-Austrian border. In his shoulder was a freshly embedded arrowhead. Thus, Keeley & Pinker document mass casualties of warfare long predating civilization. Just as important, both, starting with Keeley's subtitle, suggest a hidden agenda among archaeologists to ignore that evidence. Why had there been, to use Keeley's phrase, pacification of the past? In Chapter 7, we saw how World War II produced a generation of social scientists trying to understand the roots of fascism. In Keeley's view, the post-World War II generations of archaeologists recoiled from the trauma of the war by recoiling from the evidence that humans had been prepping a long time for World War II. For Pinker, writing from a younger generation's perspective, the current whitewashing of prehistoric violence has the flavor of today's archaeological graybeards being nostalgic about getting stoned in high school and listening to John Lennon's Imagine. Keeley and Pinker generated a strong backlash among many notable archaeologists who charged them with warifying the past. Most vocal has been R. Brian Ferguson of Rutgers University, with publications with titles like Pinker's List, Exaggerating Prehistoric War Mortality. Keeley and Pinker are criticized for numerous reasons. A. Some of the sites supposedly presenting evidence for warfare actually contain only a single case of violent death, suggesting homicide, not war. B. The criteria for inferring violent death includes skeletons in close proximity to arrowheads. However, many such artifacts were actually tools used for other purposes, or simply chips and flakes. For example, Fred Wendorf, who excavated Jebel Sahaba, considered most of the projectiles associated with skeletons to have been mere debris. C. Many fractured bones were actually healed. Instead of reflecting war, they might indicate the ritualized club fighting seen in many tribal societies. D. Proving that a human bone was gnawed on by a fellow human instead of another carnivore is tough. One tour de force paper demonstrated cannibalism in a Pueblo village from around the year 1100. Human feces there contained the human version of the muscle-specific protein myoglobin. In other words, those humans had been eating human meat. Nonetheless, even when cannibalism is clearly documented, it doesn't indicate whether there was exo- or endo-cannibalism, i.e., eating vanquished enemies versus deceased relatives, as is done in some tribal cultures. E. Most important, Keeley and Pinker are accused of cherry-picking their data, discussing only sites of putative war deaths rather than the entire literature. When you survey the thousands of prehistoric skeletal remains from hundreds of sites worldwide, rates of violent deaths are far lower than 15%. Moreover, there are regions and periods lacking any evidence of warlike violence. The glee in refuting the broadest conclusions of Keeley and Pinker is unmistakable, e.g., Ferguson in the previously cited work. For 10,000 years in the southern Levant, there is not one single instance where it can be said with confidence war was there. His emphasis. Am I wrong? Name the place. Thus, these critics conclude that wars were rare prior to human civilizations. Supporters of Keeley and Pinker retort that you can't ignore bloodbaths like Crow Creek or Jebel Sahaba, and that the absence of proof of early war in so many of these sites is not proof of absence. This suggests a second strategy for contemporary Hobbes versus Rousseau debates, namely to study contemporary humans in pre-state tribal societies. How frequently do they war? Prehistorians in the flesh. Well, if researchers endlessly argue about who or what gnawed on a 10,000-year-old human bone, imagine the disagreements about actual living humans. Keeley and Pinker, along with Samuel Bowles of the Santa Fe Institute, conclude that warfare is nearly universal in contemporary non-state societies. This is the world of headhunters in New Guinea and Borneo, Maasai and Zulu warriors in Africa, Amazonians on raiding parties in the rainforest. Keeley estimates that, in the absence of pacification enforced by outside forces such as a government, 90-95% of tribal societies engage in warfare, many constantly, and a much higher percentage are at war at any time, than is the case for state societies. For Keeley, the rare peaceful tribal societies are usually so because they have been defeated and dominated by a neighboring tribe. Keeley charges that there has been systematic underreporting of violence by contemporary anthropologists intent on pacifying living relics of the past. Keeley also tries to debunk the view that tribal violence is mostly ritualistic. An arrow in someone's thigh, a head or two bashed with a war club, and time to call it a day. Instead, violence in non-state cultures is lethal. Keeley seems to take pride in this, documenting how various cultures use weapons designed for warfare meant to cause festering damage. He often has an almost testy, offended tone about those pacifying anthropologists who think indigenous groups lack the organization, self-discipline, and Puritan work ethic to inflict bloodbaths. He writes about the superiority of tribal warriors to westernized armies, e.g., describing how in the Anglo-Zulu War, Zulu spears were more accurate than 19th-century British guns, and how the Brits won the war not because they were superior fighters, but because their logistical sophistication allowed them to fight prolonged wars. Like Keeley, Pinker concludes that warfare is nearly ubiquitous in traditional cultures, reporting 10% to 30% of deaths as being war-related in New Guinea tribes such as the Gabusi and Mayenga, and a 35% to 60% range for Warani and Hivaro tribes in the Amazon. Pinker estimates rates of death due to violence. Europe currently is in the range of one death per 100,000 people per year. During the crime waves of the 1970s and 1980s, the United States approached 10. Detroit was around 45. Germany and Russia, during their 20th century wars, averaged 144 and 135, respectively. In contrast, the 27 non-state societies surveyed by Pinker average 524 deaths. There are the Grand Valley Dani of New Guinea, the Piegan Blackfoot of the American Great Plains, and the Dinka of Sudan, all of whom in their prime approached 1,000 deaths, roughly equivalent to losing one acquaintance per year. Taking the gold are the Kato, a California tribe that in the 1840s crossed the finish line near 1,500 deaths per 100,000 people per year. No tour of violence in indigenous cultures is complete without the Yanomamo, a tribe living in the Brazilian and Venezuelan Amazon. According to dogma, there is almost always raiding between villages. 30% of adult male deaths are due to violence. Nearly 70% of adults have had a close relative killed by violence. 44% of men have murdered. Fun folks. The Yanomamo are renowned because of Napoleon Chagnon, one of the most famous and controversial anthropologists, a tough, pugnacious, no-holds-barred academic brawler who first studied them in the 1960s. He established the Yanomamo's street cred with his 1967 monograph, Yanomamo, the Fierce People, an anthropology classic. Thanks to his publications and his ethnographic films about Yanomamo violence, both their fierceness and his are well-known tropes in anthropology. A central concept in the next chapter is that evolution is about passing copies of your genes into the next generation. In 1988, Chagnon published the remarkable report that Yanomamo men who were killers had more wives and offspring than average, thus passing on more copies of their genes. This suggested that if you excel at waging it, war can do wonders for your genetic legacy. Thus, among these non-state tribal cultures standing in for our prehistoric past, nearly all have histories of lethal warfare, some virtually non-stop, and those who excel at killing are more evolutionarily successful. Pretty grim. And numerous anthropologists object strenuously to every aspect of that picture. Again with the cherry-picking, in Pinker's analysis of violence among hunter horticulturalists and other tribal groups, all but one of his examples come from the Amazon or the New Guinea Highlands. Global surveys yield much lower rates of warfare and violence. Pinker had foreseen this criticism by playing the Keeley pacification of the past card, questioning those lower rates. In particular, he has leveled this charge against the anthropologists who whom he somewhat pejoratively calls anthropologists of peace, somewhat akin to believers in the Easter Bunny, who have reported on the remarkably non-violent Semai people of Malaysia. This produced a testy letter to Science from this group that, in addition to saying that they are peace anthropologists, not anthropologists of peace, stated that they are objective scientists who studied the Semai without preconceived notions, rather than a gaggle of hippies. They even felt obliged to declare that most of them are not pacifists. Pinker's response was, "It is encouraging that anthropologists of peace now see their discipline as empirical rather than ideological, a welcome change from the days when many anthropologists signed manifestos on which their position on violence was correct and censured, shut down, or spread libelous rumors about colleagues who disagreed." Woof. Accusing your academic adversaries of signing manifestos is like a sharp knee to the groin. Other anthropologists have studied the Yanomamo, and no one else reports violence like Shagnon has. Moreover, his report of increased reproductive success among more murderous Yanomamo has been demolished by the anthropologist Douglas Fry of the University of Alabama at Birmingham, who showed that Shagnon's finding is an artifact of poor data analysis. Shagnon compared the number of descendants of older men who had killed people in battle with those who had not, finding significantly more kids among the former. However, A, Shagnon did not control for age differences. The killers happened to be an average of more than a decade older than the non-killers, meaning more than a decade more time to accumulate descendants. B, more important, this was the wrong analysis to answer the question posed. The issue isn't the reproductive success of elderly men who had been killers in their youth. You need to consider the reproductive success of all killers, including the many who were themselves killed as young warriors, distinctly curtailing their reproductive success. Not doing so is like concluding that war is not lethal, based solely on studies of war veterans. Moreover, Shagnon's finding does not generalize. At least three studies of other cultures failed to find a violence-slash-reproductive success link. For example, a study by Luke Glowatsky and Richard Wrangham of Harvard examined a nomadic pastoralist tribe, the Nyangatom of southern Ethiopia. Like other pastoralists in their region, the Nyangatom regularly raid one another for cattle. The authors found that frequent participation in large, open battle raiding did not predict increased lifelong reproductive success. Instead, such success was predicted by frequent participation in stealth raiding, where a small group furtively steals cows from the enemy at night. In other words, in this culture, being a warrior on roids does not predict amply passing on your genes. Being a low-down, sneaky varmint of a cattle rustler does. These indigenous groups are not stand-ins for our prehistoric past. For one thing, many have obtained weapons more lethal than those of prehistory. A damning criticism of Shagnon is that he often traded axes, machetes, and shotguns to Yanomamo for their cooperation in his studies. For another, these groups often live in degraded habitats that increase resource competition, thanks to being increasingly hemmed in by the outside world, and outside contact can be catastrophic. Pinker cites research showing high rates of violence among the Amazonian Ashe and Hiwi tribes. However, in examining the original reports, Fry found that all of the Ashe and Hiwi deaths were due to killings by frontier ranchers intent on forcing them off their land. This tells nothing about our prehistoric past. Both sides in these debates see much at stake. Near the end of his book, Keeley airs a pretty weird worry. The doctrines of the pacified past unequivocally imply that the only answer to the mighty scourge of war is a return to tribal conditions and the destruction of all civilization. In other words, unless this tomfoolery of archaeologists pacifying the past stops, people will throw away their antibiotics and microwaves, do some scarification rituals, and switch to loincloths. And where will that leave us? Critics on the other side of these debates have deeper worries. For one thing, the false picture of, say, Amazonian tribes as ceaselessly violent has been used to justify stealing their land. According to Stephen Corey of Survival International, a human rights organization that advocates for indigenous tribal peoples, Pinker is promoting a fictitious, colonialist image of a backward, brutal savage, which pushes the debate back over a century and is still used to destroy tribes. Amid these roiling debates, let's keep sight of what got us to this point. A behavior has occurred that is good, bad, or ambiguous. How have cultural factors stretching back to the origins of humans contributed to that behavior? And rustling cattle on a moonless night, or setting aside tending your cassava garden to raid your Amazonian neighbors, or building fortifications, or butchering every man, woman, and child in a village is irrelevant to that question. That's because all these study subjects are pastoralists, agriculturalists, or horticulturalists, lifestyles that emerged only in the last 10,000 to 14,000 years, after the domestication of plants and animals. In the context of hominin history stretching back hundreds of thousands of years, being a camel herder or farmer is nearly as newfangled as being a lobbyist advocating for legal rights for robots. For most of history, humans have been hunter-gatherers, a whole different kettle of fish. War and hunter-gatherers, past and present. Roughly 95 to 99% of hominin history has been spent in small, nomadic bands that foraged for edible plants and hunted cooperatively. What is known about hunter-gatherer, for sanity's sake, henceforth HG, violence? Given that prehistoric HGs didn't have lots of material possessions that have lasted tens of thousands of years, they haven't left much of an archaeological record. Insight into their minds and lifestyle comes from cave paintings dating back as much as 40,000 years. Though paintings from around the world show humans hunting, hardly any unambiguously depict interhuman violence. The paleontological record is even sparser. To date, there has been discovered one site of an HG massacre dating back 10,000 years in northern Kenya. This will be discussed later. What to do with this void of information? One approach is comparative, inferring the nature of our distant ancestors by comparing them with extant non-human primates. Early versions of this approach were the writings of Conrad Lorenz and of Robert Ardrey, who argued in his 1966 bestseller, The Territorial Imperative, that human origins are rooted in violent territoriality. The most influential modern incarnation comes from Richard Wrangham, particularly in his 1997 book with Dale Peterson, Demonic Males, Apes and the Origins of Human Violence. For Wrangham, chimps provide the clearest guide to the behavior of earliest humans, and the picture is a bloody one. He essentially leapfrogs HGs entirely. So we come back to the Yanomamo. Do they suggest to us that chimpanzee violence is linked to human war? Clearly they do. Wrangham summarizes his stance. The mysterious history before history, the blank slate of knowledge about ourselves before Jericho, has licensed our collective imagination and authorized the creation of primitive Edens for some, forgotten matriarchies for others. It is good to dream, but a sober, waking rationality suggests that if we start with ancestors like chimpanzees and end up with modern humans building walls and fighting platforms, the 5-million-year-long trail to our modern selves was lined, along its full stretch, by a male aggression that structured our ancestors' social lives and technology and minds. It's Hobbes all the way down, plus Keeley-esque contempt for pacification of the past dreamers. This view has been strongly criticized. A, we're neither chimps nor their descendants. They've been evolving at nearly the same pace as humans since our ancestral split. B, Wrangham picks and chooses in his cross-species linkages. For example, he argues that the human evolutionary legacy of violence is rooted not only in our close relationships to chimps, but also in our nearly as close kinship with gorillas, who practice competitive infanticide. The problem is that overall, gorillas display minimal aggression, something Wrangham ignores in linking human violence to gorillas. C. As the most significant species cherry-picking, Wrangham pretty much ignores bonobos, with their far lower levels of violence than chimps, female social dominance, and absence of hostile territoriality. Crucially, humans share as much of their genes with bonobos as with chimps, something unknown when Demonic Males was published, and notably, Wrangham has since softened his views. For most in the field, most insights into the behavior of our HG ancestors come from study of contemporary HGs. Once, the world of humans consisted of nothing but HGs. Today, the remnants of that world are in the few remaining pockets of peoples who live pure HG lives. These include the Hadza of northern Tanzania, Mbuti, pygmies in the Congo, Batwa in Rwanda, Kuingu of the Australian outback, Andaman Islanders in India, Batak in the Philippines, Semang in Malaysia, and various Inuit cultures in northern Canada. To start, it was once assumed that among HGs, women do the gathering while men supply most of the calories by hunting. In actuality, the majority of calories come from foraging. Men spend lots of time talking about how awesome they were in the last hunt and how much awesomer they'll be in the next. Among some Hadza, maternal grandmothers supply more calories to families than do the man the hunter men. The arc of human history is readily equated with an arc of progress, and key to the latter is the view that agriculture was the best thing humans ever invented. I'll rant about that later. A cornerstone of the agriculture lobby is the idea that primordial HGs were half-starved. In reality, HGs typically work fewer hours for their daily bread than do traditional farmers and are longer-lived and healthier. In the words of anthropologist Marshall Sollins, HGs were the original affluent society. There are some demographic themes shared among contemporary HGs. Dogma used to be that HG bands had fairly stable group membership, producing considerable in-group relatedness. More recent work suggests less relatedness than thought, reflecting fluid fusion-fission groupings in nomadic HGs. The Hadza show one consequence of such fluidity, namely that particularly cooperative hunters find one another and work together. More on this in the next chapter. What about our best and worst behaviors in contemporary HGs? Up into the 1970s, the clear answer was that HGs are peaceful, cooperative, and egalitarian. Interband fluidity serves as a safety valve, preventing individual violence, i.e., when people are at each other's throats, someone moves to another group. And nomadicism as a safety valve, preventing intergroup violence, i.e., rather than warring with a neighboring band, just hunt in a different valley from them. The standard bearers for HG grooviness were the Kalahari Kung. Footnote. Kung speak a click language, with the exclamation mark in their name, the notation for the click sound. Informally known as Bushmen, they are part of the larger cultural group of Khoisan San found in Botswana, Namibia, Angola, and South Africa. As orientation, the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy featured the Kung. Of note, while Kung is the most familiar term most often used for these people, both they and most contemporary anthropologists use the term Junhuansi instead. The title of an early monograph about them, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas's 1959 The Harmless People, says it all. Kung are to the Yanomamo as Joan Baez is to Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols. Naturally, this picture of the Kung in particular and HGs in general was ripe for revisionism. This occurred when field studies were sufficiently long-term to document HGs killing one another, as summarized in an influential 1978 publication by Carol Ember of Yale. Basically, if you're observing a band of 30 people, it will take a long time to see that, on a per capita basis, they have murder rates approximating Detroit's, the standard comparison always made. Admitting that HGs were violent was seen as a purging of 60s anthropological romanticism, a bracing slap in the face for anthropologists who had jettisoned objectivity in order to dance with wolves. By the time of Pinker's synthesis, HG violence was established and the percentage of their deaths attributed to warfare averaged around 15%, way more than in modern Western societies. Contemporary HG violence constitutes a big vote for the Hobbesian view of warfare and violence permeating all of human history. Time for the criticisms. Mislabeling. Some HGs cited by Pinker, Keeley, and Bowles are, in fact, hunter-horticulturalists. Many instances of supposed HG warfare on closer inspection were actually singular homicides. Some violent Great Plains HG cultures were untraditional in the sense of using something crucial that didn't exist in the Pleistocene, domesticated horses ridden into battle. Like non-Western agriculturalists or pastoralists, contemporary HG are not equivalent to our ancestors. Weapons invented in the last 10,000 years have been introduced through trade. Most HG cultures have spent millennia being displaced by agriculturalists and pastoralists pushed into ever tougher, resource-sparse ecosystems. Once again, the cherry-picking issue, i.e., failure to cite cases of peaceful HGs. Most crucially, there's more than one type of HG. Nomadic HGs are the original brand, stretching back hundreds of thousands of years. But in addition to HG 2.0 equestrians, there are complex HGs who are different. Violent, not particularly egalitarian, and sedentary, typically because they're sitting on a rich food source that they defend from outsiders. In other words, a transitional form from pure HGs. And many of the cultures cited by Ember, Keeley, and Pinker are complex HGs. This difference is relevant to Nataruk, that northern Kenyan site of a 10,000-year-old massacre. Skeletons of 27 unburied people killed by clubbing, stabbing, or stone projectiles. The victims were sedentary HGs, living alongside a shallow bay on Lake Turkana, prime beachfront property with easy fishing and plentiful game animals coming to the water to drink. Just the sort of real estate that someone else would try to muscle in on. The most thoughtful and insightful analyses of HG violence come from Fry and from Christopher Boehm of the University of Southern California. They paint a complex picture. Fry has provided what I consider the cleanest assessment of warfare in such cultures. In a notable 2013 Science paper, he and Finnish anthropologist Patrick Söderberg reviewed all cases of lethal violence in the ethnographic literature in pure nomadic HGs, i.e., well-studied before extensive contact with outsiders and living in a stable ecosystem. The sample consisted of 21 such groups from around the world. Fry and Söderberg observed what might be called warfare, defined by the fairly unstringent criterion of conflict producing multiple casualties, in only a minority of the cultures, not exactly widespread. This is probably the best approximation we'll ever get about warfare in our HG ancestors. Nonetheless, these pure HGs are no tie-dyed pacifists. 86% of the cultures experienced lethal violence. What are their causes? In his 2012 book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame, Boehm also surveys the literature using slightly less stringent criteria than Fry uses, producing a list of about 50 relatively pure nomadic HG cultures, heavily skewed toward Inuit groups from the Arctic. As expected, violence is mostly committed by men. Most common is killing related to women, two men fighting over a particular woman, or attempts to kidnap a woman from a neighboring group. Naturally, there are men killing their wives, usually over accusations of adultery. There's female infanticide and killing arising from accusations of witchcraft. There are occasional killings over garden varieties stealing of food or refusals to share food, and lots of revenge killings by relatives of someone killed. Both Fry and Boehm report killings akin to capital punishment for severe norm violations. What norms do nomadic HGs value most? Fairness, indirect reciprocity, and avoidance of despotism. Fairness. As noted, HGs pioneered human cooperative hunting and sharing among non-relatives. This is most striking with meat. It's typically shared by successful hunters with unsuccessful ones and their families, Individuals playing dominant roles in hunts don't necessarily get much more meat than everyone else. Crucially, the most successful hunter rarely decides how the meat is divided. Instead, this is typically done by a third party. There are fascinating hints about the antiquity of this. Big game hunting by hominins 400,000 years ago has been documented. Bones from animals butchered then show cut marks that are chaotic, overlapping at different angles, suggesting a free-for-all. But by 200,000 years ago, the contemporary HG pattern is there. Cut marks are evenly spaced and parallel, suggesting that single individuals butchered and dispensed the meat. This does not mean, though, that sharing is effortless for pure HGs. Boehm notes how, for example, the Kung perpetually kvetch about being shortchanged on meat. It's the background hum of social regulation. Indirect reciprocity. The next chapter discusses reciprocal altruism between pairs of individuals. Boehm emphasizes how nomadic HGs specialize instead in indirect reciprocity. Person A is altruistic to B. B's social obligation now isn't necessarily as much being altruistic to A as paying the altruism forward to C. C pays it forward to D, etc. This stabilizing cooperation